slowly rolling into it and off of corner number four. It's showtime at Skagit Speedway. Your champion last year opens his defense of his title with a win. Jeff Westergaard, your winner tonight, the IMCA Modified.
It's showtime!
One car with the front of it that was junk, and another car with the back of it was junk. So I cut both of them in half, took the good part of one car and the good part of the other car, and welded up the other.
The reason why I decided to move to Sean's number and use it was just because in memory of Sean was his V8. And, I just kind of lived for racing and racing with his number just to remember him by.
Racing, and next thing you know, she's on the flag stand running, doing flag and all my quarterback. I'm like, where did you come from?
You definitely have to want it. You can't just say you want it. You got to want it. You got to have that desire that drives you.
I hope they just, soak it all in, because you don't know when it could be over, right? Mom and Dad can't do this anymore, right? We don't have the money, or we can't find the sponsors, whatever it is. I just soak it all up while it's happening.
That was at Elma. This is a different track. I don't think it'll be the same thing. He's like, oh, okay, you can throw it on. We threw the GoPro on his car, and he actually did pretty good that night, I believe. So we're like, see? I convinced him. I was like, see, it's only at Elma. You can't rent a GoPro. And then the next week, I believe he blew up a motor with the GoPro on, so I haven't put a GoPro on his car since then.
Well, welcome into this week's edition of On the Gas, a Skagit Speedway podcast, episode 17. Eric List, Caleb Hart, and Jeff Westergaard joins us today on the phone lines. Jeff, how's it going today?
Doing great. Just sitting here at the office, working away.
Weird. Off season, you have to do actual real life work and stuff. You don't get to just fly around and drive race cars all the time, huh?
Yeah, my job is actually really cool too. So I'm doing an industry that I've never done before, and I get to work for a close friend of mine. So we do ag automation, farm automation stuff. So robotics, vision systems and things. And I know that you guys have touched on it on a couple interviews that we've done with you, but my job is a traveling job too. So I think I'm at 33 flights this year already. Wow. And I get to be in 70 to 90 degree weather every time I'm working out of town. We're working in Central Valley, Central Coast. It's beautiful down there year round, pretty much. So it's a really cool job. I get to do really cool things and work with really cool people.
Are you
having flexible employment definitely helps with traveling to get to races and making sure you can get the car together, huh?
Yeah, it's a give and take. And my company is really, when they started this company, they wanted to make sure that it was, family oriented and things like that. And make sure that we get to live our lives, not just work ourselves to death. And so there's a give and take on that. And sometimes we have to work more than other times, but it works out. And I really wanted to try to do some racing in California because that's where all my customers are. And it'd be cool to kind of share that with them as well. And I'm hoping to maybe try to do some more of that next year. I wasn't able to do it this year, but along with traveling, I can just take the race car with me and stay for the weekend too. So that's pretty cool.
So where are we talking to you today? Are you actually in Washington? Or are you down in California at the moment?
I'm at our home base in Bow, Washington.
Oh, okay.
So I work for Ian Mintz. He's a longtime, second or third generation farmer here. He's got a home base farm that we're out in Bow, and this is where my office actually is. But so when I'm home, I'm working here. But when I'm out of town, it's remote. It's on the road, working out of a truck and things like that. So I'm home now.
Oh, okay, good for you.
Yeah,
a little time to relax. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the Survive the 55. We didn't touch on that really much at the banquet. How did the Survive the 55 go for you? I know you made the A-Main, but I don't know if you made the A-Main, but I don't know if the A-Main went the way you would have hoped. But
so we had this plan. My first race in a modified was actually the Survive 55. So this year was my third Survive the 55, but second season in a modified. And so our first race. Or this race, we really had a focus on all year of trying to do good in that race and trying to to go forward. I mean, of course, the end goal is to win it, but my goal this year was a top five finish. We worked really hard, made some setup changes towards the end of the year, and started playing with the car to try to work on the dry slick tracks and running up by the fence instead of just running around the bottom on a hooked up track. And I think we really got the car dialed in. We had a really fast car. I had one of the tougher heats of the pill draw deal, and so that made it a little tougher to lock in higher. But we ended up locking into the main event Friday night, and I think we started 16th, so we didn't have to do any B mains or anything. We could really focus on just making our program go faster on the track for the main event. We started 16th, and the car, Tyson actually had me try a different shock that I hadn't tried all year. I'm like, hey, you know what? I'm going to throw it in it and see what it does. He said, I promise you'll like it. And the car has never driven better. Like, the car was so good. I wish I would have found that out 2 years ago. Like, the car was so good.
What corner did you change the shock out on?
Right rear corner. But that's all I can say because I've sworn to secrecy.
I can't. I don't want you to give up all the speed secrets, but okay. So without giving up even more speed secrets, how much different from the previous shock that you were running is it? Like, way different on compression and rebound, or just enough each direction to make a difference?
So it was enough to feel a difference in the car. And the thing I've been looking for in the car is more drive off. My car's really good in. It's really good on a hooked up track. The car's always been phenomenal on a hooked up track. And it was just enough of a jump. You know, I come from sprint cars, so I'm looking at like poundages and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was a couple steps jump. It wasn't a huge jump, but it made all the difference in the world for the slick. And going forward, I wouldn't necessarily do that jump on our normal Skagit track or anything like that, or Washington in general tracks. But, you know, when I was going out of town to Vegas and things, that would have made like all the difference in the world. And the car just drove so hard middle off. Like it was phenomenal. It was a really cool feeling. And I think we went 16th to 7th in like five laps. And I was running right through the middle, just trying to avoid carnage, just trying to survive in the beginning. And the car was driving so hard. I ended up coming down the front stretch, and I was opening up my entry going into one, and I actually tapped the wall on my right rear quarter, and it pushed the deck down, and I made it all year without shredding a tire. You know how my tire thing was last year. Uh-huh. I made it all year without separating or ruining a tire. Uh-huh. And my quarter panel got pushed into my right rear tire and pulled all the tread off down to cords. Wow. So the first half I was moving forward. I'm like, man, we got a top five car. This car is working really good. I can run wherever I want on the racetrack. It's got drive. I'm just, you know, I was like quarter half throttle, just trying to maintain and take the, you know, risk management in the first half of the race. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I didn't know what happened, but all of a sudden my car just started dump trucking backwards. I couldn't go forward in the middle, the bottom, the top. I couldn't drive it in softer, harder. It didn't matter. And I was really confused. And at the break, I came in, I'm like, they're like, what do you want to do? I'm like, whatever happened the last half of that, or the second quarter of the race, we need to get that back to the beginning. Cause I lost all drive, and we started looking at the car, and we found that all my tread was off my tire.
Oh.
And so that was an easy fix. We just put a new tire on it, and we had a good car. But by that time I had fallen back to like 19th or something. Mm-hmm. And so the rest of the middle groove kind of wore out a little bit, and it was a very bottom or all the way at the very top, like literally banging the boards down. And I was kind of, you know, I was maintaining no matter where I was at. I got in a really good race with Devin Reed. I wasn't stuck racing with him. He wasn't holding me up, but having to race with him that hard made it hard to move forward, because mm-hmm. we were literally side by side for like 18 laps or something. I don't even know how many laps we raced. We raced together side by side forever. And then I've never been able to drive a modified around a racetrack that is like, I like to compare it to like Deming and a midget banging the wall down, or Tulare. Like, that was the most fun I've ever had in a modified. I think I finished like where I started 16th or something, but I had the most fun I've ever had. I was literally... It was intimidating running this big of a car that close to the fence. And I've always wanted to take a right recorder and smash it in like you see on the, you know, Flow Racing, watching the late models. They're just banging the boards down. And I finally got it done. It was cool. I have to do body work now, but it was it was amazing.
Worth it, right?
Oh, yeah. No, that was – I had white paint on my rear bumper from skipping around the wall. Like, if I didn't get in there hard enough, I would actually – would suck my right front up into the cushion, and it was – it reminded me of like sprint car racing, being able to run around the top like that. It was a phenomenal racetrack. That was so much fun.
You mentioned banging the boards and like sprint car racing. I know the cars don't drive the same, but when you were up that high, could you use similar driving techniques and styles between how you bang the boards in a sprint car, between how you're banging the boards in the modified?
There's an old timer told me once, he said, the closer you are to the wall, the less it hurts when you hit it.
Genie so bars.
that's weird to say Jamie Barnes is an old timer, but I guess he is, huh?
Well, I know exactly who told you that one, because the first time I jumped in the midget, that's the same advice he gave me.
So it was, you know, when you're running up top like that, these cars are really finesse. You only got that 8-inch tire that's super hard compound. Mm-hmm. And so they're really finesse to get off the corner. But when you're up in the cushion like that, you can drive the piss out of the car. So that was a lot of fun.
All right.
And at that point, it's just who drives it in deeper and doesn't mess up. I mean, or doesn't hit the wall. That's who's going to get faster through the corner.
And that's really your background. Like, I know it's something that you've talked about on this show before, but like, first time that I remember meeting you was working with the group of micros that you worked with. What was it? Jim Burdick's operation that he had getting together. Right. And then, into the sprint car from there. So it's been an open wheel sprint car life from you from the beginning. It's just kind of had this weird, interesting racing path that puts you into a modified, now being a 2-time champion.
Yeah, it was, I wouldn't take back any of my racing. Like I've been blessed to be able to race for people. I've raced a lot of different things, and I really enjoy the challenge. So learning a new car instead of just like beating the learning curve down year after year after year in the same car. It's I've been blessed to be able to drive different things, whether it's my cars or other people's cars. I think the only thing I haven't driven in the Northwest is a 410 sprint car, and I've never driven an open midget. Everything else in between I've raced. Huh. And so that's been really cool to experience. And, you know, I started racing at Deming in 250s. I don't come from a racing family. Nobody in my family ever raced before. And I went to my first dirt track in like the early 2000s, and it was Skagit. And then my dad ended up dating somebody that her son was racing a 250 up at Deming. And I actually have a little background. Kyle Hansen's mom and my mom were friends when I was younger. So I think I saw him once up at Langley in a quarter midget. But after I started going, I was older. I was like, okay, I got to do this. This is awesome. This is what I want my life to be. And little did I know, that got shot into the veins and I can't get rid of it.
To the point where you made it your full-time job for that period of time, it just occurred to me when we had mentioned it, when Eric had mentioned, you know, your outlaw experience going out and racing around with Rick Rogers and learning under the Scott Bennick learning tree. I had forgot about that period of time in your career.
Yeah. So when I was younger, you know, every young driver's dream is to make a living in driving. It's few and far between to be able to do it. But I mean, if you have enough passion and enough sacrifices to give up for it, and then obviously the financing comes behind it. I really wanted to make driving my career when I was younger. And so one of those steps was to go out on the Outlaw Tour. And I actually went out twice, but the first time didn't work out. It was not a good fit. It was last minute. I think he offered me the job and flew me out that night. Wow. And it just didn't work out when I was on the road. I think I was out for like 2 weeks. And then not growing up, but being around and racing for quite a few years before that, I made some friends, and Logan Forler was actually at Knoxville when I decided to come home. And so I ended up riding home with Logan Forler. And then I said, you know, that just wasn't for me. That wasn't a good fit. And then a little later, I think the next season, I got a deal through, actually, it was Jamie Barnes's old ride.
Yeah.
Rick Rogers put it together for him. Yeah, Brandon Wimmer was the driver when I went out. And then we had Jack Hodenshield in there. We had Lucas Wolf. I think we had a couple others. I can't remember.
All in one year.
I ended up.
Those different drivers?
We had different drivers in there. We were trying to, it was a new team. We were trying to be competitive and they were trying to change some things around to see what is a better fit. You know, the crew chief was solid. They wanted to stay with him. He was really smart. He's been in the industry for a long time. He used to work for Tony Stewart and things. I mean, he's still in the industry.
Who was it?
And Scott Bennick.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So
USAC winning car owner and crew chief at the time, like speed shop owner, super smart shock and engine guy. Like you could, Scott was a good wrench. Like you said, Scott was not the problem there.
Yeah, Scott was, and I wouldn't say any of the drivers were the problem either. I think it was just trying to get the right mesh. So
yeah,
long story short, we were trying to figure out a good program, trying to figure out how to go out and compete on a nightly basis. I mean, there were some races for weeks. We were racing 10 races in 11 days, I think the West Coast Tour was, and things like that. And I wanted to go out and get the experience. I wanted to be around it every day. I wanted to be, learn how to properly do the sponsorship side of it, the parts buying side of it, the maintenance side of, I mean, the whole thing, doing it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, Rick Rogers was a cool guy to work for. Scott Bennick, I was with him every day. I lived at the shop. Scott really took me under his wing and gave me more and more as the race season went on. He gave me more and more trust to help him build cars or help him do motor maintenance or like he really took me under his wing. And I learned a ton from him. Some things I didn't even know I learned until even like now. I'm like, oh yeah, Scott showed me this. This is the way to do it. And so it's stuff that stuck with me, and it was a amazing experience. I really loved it. And if I didn't have kids, I would still be out doing it. Like it's an incredible life to live.
Right. Cause at the time you had Caden, right. You had your oldest at that point and basically hanging out at home. You didn't get to see her all that often.
Yeah. That's why I came home. I got homesick. It was fine when we were racing. Mm-hmm. I missed my daughter. She was young. She was only like 2 or 3. But I missed my daughter. But when we were racing a ton, I was able to keep my mind busy on racing and didn't get so homesick and miss my daughter. Like, you know, I wasn't thinking about all that stuff when I was so focused on racing. And when the season started slowing down and we were spending time at the house, we had an actual crew house in Indiana. That's when it really hit me. And that's when I started deciding that, you know, if I can't have her out there with me that young, I wanted to be a part of her life. And if I couldn't have her out there with me that young, I needed to come home and spend some time at home.
That's really respectable. And I think
now I got 4 kids. So
you spend even more, and now you're going on the road for your job.
Again. Yeah. I actually had my own company. I had a dirt company. I had a dump truck and I did driveways and stuff. And it was really stressful. My wife really liked that I was doing we had our own thing together. But when this opportunity came up, I said, it's going to be travel. But our goal was to have her stay at home with the kids and, you know, raise our children and really be a good home stability life, not getting babysitters and stuff. And so part of that, I said, you know, with this opportunity, you can stay home. And that's a sacrifice that her and I are making. And I try to mind my P's and Q's with traveling during certain occasions and things like that, but it does get a little tough sometimes.
Oh, I'm sure.
When did your wife, Mariah, come into your world?
So I was 30 and I actually met her online. I was tired of the Skagit Valley rotation or whatever you want to call it. And I was like, you know what? I need to go outside of my comfort zone and find somebody elsewhere. And I wasn't really looking for anything serious, but her and I, she's 9.5 years younger than me. She couldn't even go to the bar when we first met each other. And I was riding my Harley and she's like, well, I want to go. I'm like, well, I'm sorry. We're going to go out to the corner or something for lunch and you can't go. So,
oh gosh. Did she have any racing background at all? Or is she brand new?
None.
Wow.
She comes from
I mean, you have to speak for her here real quick, but what was the adjustment for her coming into your world and having racing become this gigantic thing?
So I didn't even really, I mean, I raced a little bit when we first met, but it was, I actually was taking a break from racing when we first met. So we were able to go camping and do all that stuff. And then I was like, the first car I got back into, I think it was Bundy's car, his sprint car. He's like, hey, I can't race this weekend. Can you come run my car? I'm like, yeah, that's not a problem. I miss racing. Well, that's what got the whole thing going again. But I got back racing, and she actually liked it. She's very non-competitive. She could care less about, or before, she could care less about winning anything or doing anything. She's just very low-key and relaxed. And then it started just kind of snowballing from there. About, we ended up buying a midget. I raced Bundy's car quite a few times. We ended up buying a midget and then raced the whole series. And then she's like, okay, that was fun, but maybe race a little bit less next year. And then the next year I ended up racing more, I think. I mean,
oh boy,
we've been averaging, other than this year, we've been averaging like 40 to 50 races a year.
Wow.
Between everything. And so we have a deal now. She, with the kids, it's kind of tough because we got an 8-month-old and a 2-year-old. And she said that it's fine if I want to race, but she's not going to try to attempt to make every single race this year or this last couple of years. So we made that deal. That way she can keep her sanity and I can keep my sanity behind the wheel. It actually, I think she only missed a few races this year, and it's different not having her around, but it still satisfies the racing program where I can race as much as I want to, and she can go hang out with her family or just stay home for the weekend or whatever if she wants to.
You know, that's one of the sneaky things about the Northwest Focus Midget Series, and part of what they got into, and especially over the past couple of seasons of Galen and Carla having it, those schedules were packed. You know, there was something literally every weekend between the dirt and the pavement, depending on what you wanted to do. You could run 40-plus nights a year, 50-plus nights a year, depending on how far you wanted to travel, et cetera, get in and through, and then mix in the fact that you're running multiple cars. You've probably been behind the seat as much as any driver in the Northwest over the last, I'm going to say, 4 years or so?
Yeah, it was cool. I saw there was the gentleman that was doing the stats for all the drivers in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. I think I was second on races actually entered, or main events made, I think is what it was. And I can't remember who the first place was. Might have been like Starks or somebody like that, because he was doing some traveling and things too. But it's, when you look back at it and you actually start counting your races, the summer goes by so fast because you're racing so much. And then you're like, oh man, I hit, you know, all these Oregon races, or I hit this Vegas race, or it's, I just like racing. I like, and I think it makes any driver that spends the most time on the track they can, they're just going to be that much better. So I try to race as much as I can. And it's sometimes a curse of mine, but I really think it helps.
So you started your year with the modified kind of going and running down in Arizona. Did your family come with you earlier this year, or was that just kind of you going out on the road before the Skagit Speedway season started?
So I ended up not doing Arizona this year.
Oh, okay.
But
my bad.
Last year, yeah. So last year when I bought the modified, I ran the Survive 55. And then I wanted to go. They had 10 or 12 races in 2 weeks. I think it was 12 nights on the track in 2 weeks. And, oh, no, it was 10 nights on the track in 2 weeks. And our Skagit season, you know, is right around that 10 mark with the modifieds. And I didn't want to come into the year blind on trying to figure out how to drive this thing. So we went down. We actually had, my son was 7 months old at the time. I was looking at hotels, and it was going to be kind of expensive to go. And so I ended up buying a camper for like $1,700, a truck bed camper. And me, my wife, two dogs, and my 7 month old son lived in a camper for 3 weeks trying to go do that Arizona thing. And,
oh, wow.
You know, we raced the whole season in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And got to learn, got to, get a lot of info from the guys like Gray Ferrando and Tyson Blood. We became friends down there. Devin Reed, all those guys were helping me, and they wanted to see, I mean, they want competition. So they want to try to boost you up to be able to compete with them and not just be a problem on the racetrack. So they were all in on helping me with setup and helped me with the car and helped me with motor stuff. And I learned a ton. So when I came into Skagit last year, my first year in the modifieds, we already had a system set up. We already had a car set up. So it was really cool to be competitive right out of the gate.
What was some of that learning process in the modified? Like, you've run so many open wheel, but going to the modified, was it a stark learning curve, or did you feel like you picked it up relatively quickly?
They don't drive like any race car I've ever raced, and they're everything I've ever raced is like, you know, left rear dominant or right rear dominant, and these cars are very right front dominant, and they when they get up in dynamic with their when they're up on the chain and up on the suspension when they're lifted up, it's just the feeling alone really throws you off as a open wheel guy coming into these. And then to the fact of that, the car weighs, you know, twice as much as everything I normally race. So trying to get the car woed up for the corner or trying to, you know, pass a car, things like that, there's a huge learning curve in trying to get this 2,500 pound car to manipulate like an open wheel car does. And then so it's feeling the setup stuff, the way the car drives, and under yellow it sounds like these things are like trying to delete every part off the car. They shake and rattle and bang, and it's there's a clutch in them, so you got to learn how to drive that stuff. It's a completely different clutch than a regular operation. There's literally no comparison other than when you're up on the cushion and your mentality wise, that's the only thing that relates.
So you've got a whole lot of new toys to play with in terms of ways that you can set up and adjust the modified. Did you start by attacking it with a sprint car mindset, or did you, were you quickly able to kind of pivot to the things that Gray and Tyson were telling you about? Hey, this is where you adjust on the modified to make X happen or make Z happen, right? We go into the sprint car world and we want to tighten the race car up. We're, you know, sucking the right rear end, changing our spacing, right? Was the modified similar, or is it a whole new ballgame in terms of how you adjust on it as well?
I mean, I'm still learning every day about the modified, but when I got the car originally out of Oregon, it was set up pretty good. So I took it to Skagit and raced that Survive weekend, and we were putting down some decent laps. And so I took it down to Arizona with that setup, didn't change anything. I didn't know anything about this car. I was just going down there to get laps. And Tyson and some other local guys, and then, like I said, Gray and those guys and Devin were an open book to get me to feel more comfortable in the car. I think they ended up telling me to drop the nose down and do some other stuff. And once we got the car set and scaled right and things like that, the changes that I make on the car throughout the night are just wheel spacing, like you had said. But so I'm moving my right rear in or putting a deeper offset on the tire, and then moving my left rear out to get more drive. So the wheel spacing is the same as a sprint car, but you're doing like I don't even know how many changes are on this car. There's like 7,000 changes on a modified that you can change to do different things on the track. And we did a couple things early with like bar angles, and then we really didn't change it much after that, other than stagger and wheel spacing.
Which is, it's almost kind of right out of the modern day sprint car playbook, is that once you find your balance, leave it. And then just tinker on little stuff based on track condition and what the heck you're needing on that individual night, right?
Yeah, and we had a good program. We've always had a good fast car in the hooked up tracks. Louis Nutter actually told me one time, he's like, I don't know how you drive it in so hard into the corner, but you drive that thing in like a sprint car. I'm like, well, maybe that's my benefit, is I can drive it in like a sprint car. Like, I just barrel the thing into the corner and then figure out what I got after that. And so
I'd almost say that that's consistent with some of the faster guys in the division, right? Both the Smith brothers, it looks very, very similar when Rick and Kevin are on. You can see the extra miles per hour they have coming into the turn. And then at about the apex, they're like, oh, okay, here's what I got to do to get off the corner at this point in time. And you make that adjustment, right?
What's the common denominator there?
Sprint car guys.
Yeah, they're all sprint car guys.
Although the Smiths did start in late models, so.
Yeah, but I think they spent, I mean, I don't know what their years are, but I think they spent a majority of their time in sprint cars, right?
A long time. Yeah. It's probably 50-50 at this point between them, because they were late model guys in the 80s and that class kind of died in the 90s and then into the sprint car, but not necessarily all the way full time for a while. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I bet you it's a little more balanced now, considering the back half of their careers have been stock cars again, you know, modifieds. But again, so much time in the sprint car. All right, cool. My corner entry speed means a lot there.
Yep, for sure.
We had Cole Logan on the program a couple weeks ago, and one of the things he talked about, and I couldn't wrap my head around it, so I'm curious if you can help elaborate more, was the chain system and how you have chains in the back of the car.
Yeah, so in a sprint car, you got the wing, the downforce, everything pushing you down to try to build traction. In one of these cars, the body does do a lot, but the car, you set these cars up on a raised up position. So in the late models, they talk about a droop rule and things like that. Mm-hmm. So these cars, when they get into the corner, they get really hard up onto the right front, and then you have to build traction in the rear. So there's chains back there. There's a chain on the right rear and a chain on the left rear that limit the amount of lift the car can do while it's in the corner. And so it's backwards from a sprint car, because we don't have the wing and everything pushing us down. And then they're trying to build traction by holding the car where it needs to be to put the weight where it needs to be. So it's, you can lengthen your chain on the left rear to get the left rear to drop farther to do something, or you can tighten it. You can tighten the chain up to get the left rear not drop as far. And then the right rear, I never played with the right rear. I didn't really learn that one, but I played with the left rear a little bit. It's limiting chains to let the car roll up to a certain point and stop.
So it's how you make downforce a little bit.
It's kind of like downforce or suspension in a sprint car, but
okay.
Not.
It's, I mean, drive.
It's building the dynamic drive of when the car's up on the up on the suspension, you want to keep it there. Whereas sprint car, you want to keep a sprint car squatted down. Mm-hmm. You want to keep a modified stood up.
Okay,
it's
that
part
makes
of the
sense.
Reason that you'll see Lawrence O'Connor was explaining this to me. Like, it's part of the reason that on restarts and such like that, not only will you see you guys, you know, swerve around to scrub your tires, but at some point in time, what, like about middle of the back straightaway, you all kind of stand on the brake, right, to get the thing up and in the air and on the suspension. That way, you're not flat going into the corner and building speed, right?
Hmm. Yeah. So you get your car. They have most of the cars have a brake floater on the left rear. So there's four corners or four brakes and four corners, but the left rear is on a floating system. So when you hit the brakes, it actually pulls the car up and the suspension down. And so I actually learned this the hard way. If you don't put your car up on the bars like that and stood up, it has no traction on the restart. So you just blow your tires off. And so once you get your car up in dynamic like that and up on the bars, you do that by riding the power braking it more or less and get the car loaded up. So when you're standing on the gas on the start, it has traction.
In the sprint car world, we'd call it trail braking, right?
It's trail braking in this stuff too, but you don't, I mean, I personally don't really, I do it a little bit on starts, but on these cars, you cannot go unless you do that.
Hmm. Okay.
Another piece added to the puzzle.
Yeah.
And it's part of what makes them so complex, right?
Yeah.
They're so cool to me, and I will never fully probably understand how they work, but the same way a sprint car is so complex.
I only understand like 2% of these things, so.
Well, perfect.
Well, and to that extent, you're looking to take that knowledge and make it a, not necessarily a thing of the past, but not your present, as you had stated at the banquet that the idea coming up for 2026 is looking for a sprint car again.
Yeah, so sprint cars is where my heart's at. That's where my knowledge is at. That's where my whole racing career has been spent other than the last 2 years, whether it's midgets, micros, sprint cars or wing sprint cars, wingless sprint cars. And that's where my love is at. And that's where my passion is at. And I jumped in some sprint cars in the last few years, but I got in a car towards the end of the season and it really brought that back to me. And I couldn't get back in love with the modified after that. And I made the decision, you know, as of right now, I've made a decision. I only got a few years left of racing unless sponsorship or or I get to drive for somebody works out, because my son turns 5 and I want to start racing quarter midgets and stuff with him, and I don't want to take anything away from him. So I made the decision this year, I'm gonna stop doing the modified, sell the modified, and put everything I got into the next few years of racing sprint cars and try to make it happen and try to go have fun and really fall back in love with that and bring it back into my life.
It was it John Simmons who gave you the first 360 ride that you had?
Yeah, so I put a deal together. So I ran like Burdick Sporty.
Yep.
And then the 360, I made a deal with John Simmons. He had a car sitting forever. We ended up going out for, he said, let's try it out. We ended up going out for Play Day the first year and scattered the motor in like 3 laps. It threw like 3 rods out the bottom. And so that put us out that year. And then we rebuilt, got back out the next year. And I actually ran okay, not good, but okay. And then we ended up pulling the wing off and running some wingless stuff. And I really excelled in the wingless stuff. And then, you know, the last half of the, or the, I think it was like after Dirt Cup, we ended up bringing the 360 up for Dirt Cup. And we were in a transfer position for the A main at Dirt Cup in a 360. We were going to get the bonus. And then it rained out that year.
Oh, gosh. 2013?
Is that the year Brock won?
No.
No? Okay.
And nobody won it.
Oh, wait, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It rained out completely. One Dirt Cup. One time.
Yeah, we tried to run it on Sunday, and it was still raining, so we ended up just, they canceled Dirt Cup that year.
Oh, okay.
So now flashback in your head, you remember what we tried to do after we lost Sunday? We tried to schedule it the night before the Outlaws came that year.
Oh, I can't remember that. I don't remember that.
I remember the controversy off of that one. That was a bunch of fun. So we said, okay, we tried to get, I remember we got Thursday and Friday in, but Friday had started looking sketchy, and then it was just buckets pouring on Saturday. Okay, this isn't going to go. Sunday looked a little bit better, but Sunday still couldn't be a thing. And, you know, first year in the, at that point in time, almost 40 years of Dirt Cup that we had lost. So the idea was that the Outlaws were coming Labor Day weekend, and most of California could come back up and try to run Dirt Cup Saturday on the Thursday night before the Outlaw show. Problem is that within your National Touring Series contracts, they have provisions written around about how soon you can have a race before Outlaw events and how much money you can pay for it and et cetera, et cetera. And everything within that contract basically said, no, you can't run a Dirt Cup event. You can't run a $25,000 to win, $20,000 to win that year, one or the other, non-sanctioned 410 show the night before we bring our sanctioned Outlaw show in. It's part to protect their brand, you know what I mean? And part of that, and I get it. And at that point in time, it was a business decision, right? Like, for the promotion staff, it's, do we risk our Outlaw contract and the big crowd that's coming for that to try to get one more day of racing in, and rocking a hard place, right? Like, okay, well, we're losing Dirt Cup this year, but we kept the Outlaw show, and it was a good Outlaw show. But yeah, that one was tough because for a while, your Dirt Cup Saturday was scheduled for the Thursday before a Friday, Saturday Outlaw show until they kind of went, hey, you guys can't do this. Read the language.
So, the Outlaws were just 2 days back then?
Yeah, for a while.
Oh, okay. So that's how the Thursday show would have worked.
It really didn't jump into being a 3-day show until 7-8 years ago, late 2010s, if I remember right. But yeah, that was the thing on that one. So Jeff still could have made that a main event up until about, I don't know, early August when the Outlaws said, nope, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah, until all the Outlaws come through the B main to try to win the show too. And the little old 360 ain't going to go anywhere.
Right. Well, at that point in time, too, right? Like, if anybody who hadn't come up before, like, the Outlaws wouldn't have been able to. Their contracts would have prevented them from running. But anybody else that would have showed up, yeah, like, who hadn't already, like, previously qualified, they could try coming up through back of the show and trying to get there. So the little 360 that could almost did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I forgot that you had all that wingless time. What was it like? I'm completely night and day from running the wing sprint car, and especially considering how much you ran Elma at that time, taking the wing off must have felt like you were into a stock car or something.
So we, John Simmons Motorsports and I, we ended up parting ways a little shortly after their Dirt Cup, and I was looking for something to drive, and I got a call from a couple different people down in Oregon. And they had liked the way I drove in the wingless car when I tried it in that Simmons car. And so I was able to go run the Competition Motorsports house car. It's the parts store that was down in Portland. He's not open anymore, but he had an open-headed old USAC 360 motor in there.
Wow.
And I got to go run for him at some of the Oregon tracks. And I think we ran Elma. We ran quite a few races together. And this was... I can't remember what year that was, but I drove Jerry Schramm. He had that series down there. It was a Sportsman crate thing. I ended up driving for him and those things that year to fill out that year. And I had a lot of fun, and driving a wingless sprint car is like nothing else. Like, I've always said that if I won the lottery, I would most likely not go hit a high limit schedule or a outlaw schedule. I would move to Indiana and go run USAC 410 races. That is so much fun. Wingless, I excelled at wingless very early, and it became more of a driver thing, less about how much money you spent, and then you can't even get all your horsepower down to the ground anyways. So it really, you can compete in a wingless car with down horsepower just no problem. And so I really excelled in that. I was able to control my wheel spin. Those cars are incredible. The open 360 in a wingless car feels like it's got 1300 horsepower because they are so unhooked with the wing gone that they just wheelie and bounce off the cushion and they're an incredible experience. I absolutely love wingless cars.
That was a cool little series, and it still exists to this day.
What was that series? Yeah,
the wingless sprint series back in the day.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was like Northwest Wingless Tour at one point. I don't know if it's still the same or just Wingless Tour, but most of their race, it's a traveling series. Most of their races are in Oregon, but they do come up to Elma. It'd be really cool to see them up at Skagit, but I think I haven't done that in a long time. I think they used to do it, but.
I was going to say first year of the new regime, I think we brought them up as the support division for 360 Nationals. And the idea would be, some of our guys will take the wing off and run with them as well. That didn't happen. And there was, I want to say it was a 10 car show, but it was a fun 10 car show. That's for sure.
Yeah. Wingless cars I think they're fun to watch. They're one of my favorite to watch. I think they're one of my favorite to drive. Like they're awesome. Especially when you get in Indiana, when you got 40, 50 cars showing up and it's the best of the best drivers. Like, they race so good. They race so hard with each other, but there's a lot of respect because we all know wingless cars are more dangerous. You don't have the cushion when you go over, a lot of guys get hurt in wingless cars. So that's part of the standard up here is all these wing drivers have grown up knowing that wingless cars are more dangerous. And, you know, I've talked to friends that their parents wouldn't even let them run wingless when we'd had wingless shows up at Deming or anything like that because you can get hurt.
So let's go big picture here. Let's go driver, driver end only, right? Places that you have raced. What's been your favorite track to race on in a wingless sprint car?
A wingless sprint car, favorite track. That's a tough one. Probably like Willamette. Willamette is raced really well with those wingless 360s. Because it was always a two or three groove track. Elma was big. It was fun, but it was kind of big for the wingless cars. Banks was fun, but it was really small for the wingless cars. I would probably say in a wingless sprint car, I would probably say Willamette, because it's got a fence on the top that you can lean up against. They always have a good racing surface. It's always slick there. I really do like slick tracks. And those Oregon tracks always get slick. So yeah, if it was wingless car, I would go Willamette on the tracks I've ran.
What about the wing sprint car?
You can't go wrong with good old Skagit. That track, especially when it gets slick off and you're running up top, that's a lot of fun. Cottage Grove puts on good wing sprint car races. I don't think I've ever ran a wing sprint car race at Willamette. I think wing sprint cars, I would probably go with Skagit because it's comfortable for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about the midget?
That's a tough one. So Deming is my love, right? Like, that's where I started racing. I've been racing there for 21 years. Like, that track, in a Focus midget, that track is phenomenal. When it gets, I'm going to repeat myself again. When it gets around the top up there and you're hitting the white paint for traction around the fence, that track is so much fun.
The midgets are fun to watch around Deming, so I bet.
Can confirm, Deming in a midget, good time.
So Deming, if you have, so like the good solid crowd of Focus midgets, it is incredible to race. But when you're coming up on lap traffic, that's a really, really hard track to race. So it's the bottom groove and the top groove. You're down the straightaway, you're in the same spot. And the corner entry difference is like 30 miles an hour between running the bottom and running the top. So it gets really sketchy there.
It's so technical and it's so tight. Like, you learn to race close with people. You learn to race in traffic. You learn, you have to know where the groove is there. Like, if you're out of the groove, if you've missed the track changing, you're out to lunch. Like, yeah, Deming in a Focus midget is, Deming in a Focus midget will teach you to be a better driver in the 100%. Other places that you go to race.
Deming in anything will teach you to be a better driver.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's so tight.
It's a little easier now that the inside wall isn't there, but with the inside wall there, oh my God.
I miss the inside wall.
You know how many times I broke my hand on that inside wall? I broke my thumb like three times. Yeah, because you remember when we used to pit in the middle there?
Yeah.
Well, the fast line in a 600 was bouncing your left front tire around the wall and trying not to hook it on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
It
was great for front axle sales.
Oh, dude, I don't know how many front axles. I had like three front axles, a rotation that I would just put in the press every week because you bend an axle there like every week. And I have a bad habit of my thumbs go inside my wheel instead of up on top.
Ooh, yeah.
And I still have that problem. And it's just a habit that I can't break. And at Deming, when you'd go in there and you enter just a inch too soon, your left front tire hits the wall and rips the wheel out of your hands. Well, the spoke would come around and pull your thumb down. And so I broke my thumb, like, I don't know, two or three times around that racetrack running mini sprints, and it hurts really bad. But that wall, I like that wall, and I really like pitting inside because you can watch all the races, and it's a whole different, like, a whole different night being in
the
pit.
It was a vibe.
I love pitting in the infield. Like, Skagit, Deming, I absolutely love it. I wish I could go back to that. I would volunteer to pit in the pits every weekend if I could.
Favorite track to run on in a modified?
Oh, Yuma was really fun. I really like the big tracks in these modifieds. Yuma is a big half mile, and that was, I think, it's a small half mile, I think. And that track was a lot of fun. You get a lot of aero around that racetrack. I also got to go to Vegas. Vegas was, besides the rocks that were in the surface that you were getting pelted with, like baseballs coming at you at 300 miles an hour, that track was really cool too, because that track got around the top, the half mile. I really liked the big tracks on those cars. Where else did I run in that thing? Vegas, Elma, Yuma. I would have to probably say Yuma was my favorite in a modified.
Okay.
Now, the Skagit's really fun, and I really appreciate Skagit running the modified class, but I really, really, really desire dry slick tracks, especially in the modified. And it slicks off sometimes, but like glass smooth, glass slick all the way to the fence where you can literally have no traction anywhere on the track. You really have to go south to get that. And that's not taking anything away from anybody, but the Yuma got glass slick all the way to the fence, and that was a lot of fun.
Is that partially what made the 55 so fun too, because that track slicked off and because it did kind of what you want? I mean, that's, I feel like, what all the guys have talked about.
Yes.
Yeah.
If and I'll tell you right now, if Skagit Speedway surface was like the Survive 55 main event every single week, I would think twice about going back to sprint cars. That was because these cars really drive. They're better to drive. It's better racing on the slick track. But, you know, one of the downfalls of our local racing scene here is we have three different styles of cars, but you can't do a track for both cars on the same night. Mm-hmm. And so it's really tough to be able to get it bone slick for the modified guys and have it, you know, somewhat of moisture in the sprint car guys, because if it goes bone slick, the sprint car guys are just destroying tires and it's really hard to drive. It doesn't make as good a racing as the modifieds make on that bone slick track. So it's
a fine balance.
If we had that. Yeah. And it's, you know, we're, like I said, my heart's in sprint cars. So I support the sprint car style tracks and things, but I still do like a dry slick track, even in a sprint car.
Yeah.
So I think I answered it. Yuma would be my favorite in the modified.
All right. And then you've been to a lot of places, right? Not necessarily as a driver. Favorite non-Skagit Speedway track as a crew guy?
Oh.
Well, that kind of comes with a vent too, though, right? So
okay.
The best experience I've ever had in racing was going to the Knoxville Nationals. The whole 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks you're there or whatever, living out of a hotel and the, you know, the grocery store parking lot, maintaining the cars, and especially because we ran the 360 Nationals and the 410 Nationals, and so we lived there for a while, and that whole event, that whole racetrack is, oh my gosh, like, that is so cool. The buildup, the racing, you can't even see the race cars all the way around the racetrack. When you're watching your car run, you have to watch the big screen for half of the lap, and I didn't know sprint cars could go that fast. They are absolutely moving. It's terrifying to watch.
A little bit.
What's their corner entry there? Like 150 miles an hour?
They're about, yeah.
Yeah.
That, I got to go to Eldora too, but I don't think it's a fair assessment because I didn't get to go to like the King's Royal or something like that. I got to just go to a regular Outlaw Eldora event. Mm-hmm. I mean, regular Outlaw event. It's all Outlaw events, and these big national touring series events are really cool, but I got to go to the Knoxville Nationals that year. And so Eldora was, that place is like a coliseum pulling into it. Like first impressions, Eldora is the coolest place that you could go just see and not even watch a race car. And then especially the Nationals, the whole town literally thrives off of the sprint cars. Like, it's not a big town. It's, what is this, the size of LeConnor? The place is tiny.
Ish. Yeah, it's not big.
It's not big.
Although it's growing. And it's gotten bigger every year from what I've told.
Yeah, and so, like, I got to go to those. So, you know, those big, huge events would probably make it the reason why it's my favorite racetrack to go watch. And that would be, oh, man, I forgot about Tulare.
Oh,
Tulare's cool too.
How can you forget about Tulare?
Especially on Trophy Cup week. Trophy Cup kicks off tonight.
Yeah, I got to go to the High Limits at Tulare last year. I was working down there. That was a cool event too. But I'll stay with my pick, and I would say Knoxville.
Okay,
just the racing museum, the everything that's around that place. It's a phenomenal experience, and I really highly suggest anybody that likes racing to go to that event.
It's interesting to hear you bring up the speed, because sprint cars are intimidating. At Knoxville, I stood at the entry of turn one, and that was one of the times I was like, holy cow, this is really intimidating just to stand here as they enter the turn. Like, that was cool, but I was like, holy cow, they are going fast.
You know, when I was in my 20s, I mean, I'm not that old now, but I'm definitely old for, or older for a guy racing and things like that. I'm 36 now, but you know, those guys are like 18 years old rolling that track at 150 miles an hour with no cares in the world. And maybe it's just because I got kids and I got a life and everything now, and I own my home. Like, I'm not scared of getting hurt, but I try to risk manage. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I would actually think twice if, especially where I'm sitting at now, where I've never driven a 410, and it's been a long time since I've been full time in a wing sprint car. I mean, I've raced them here and there, but I haven't been full time in a long time. Mm-hmm. And so, I actually made a joke with my crew. I said, if Tony Stewart or Rico Abreu, whoever, called me and said, "Hey, we need a 410 driver and we want you to run Knoxville," I think I would tell him to pound sand. Like, I don't know if I have the cojones to be able to go run that track right now. That is so scary.
It's different when you're married with kids and have other things to think about, right?
Responsibilities.
Yeah.
Yep, I understand it. And something that a lot of guys echo is that, you know, when it was just me and it was only me that I had to worry about, things are a little bit different. You race a little bit different then, too. Mm-hmm. There's a level of care about your own well-being that you can kind of set aside for a moment. And then things change. Things change when you have a family. So, I understand that. It's one of the things I appreciate about you, Jeff, because I see how much you've tried to incorporate them when they are there at the track into your day and, you know, saying, "Hey, I'm ready to hang it up here in a few years. That way we can go quarter midget racing and, you know, you can have the first second generation racer in your family." That's a cool deal.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I was talking to my dad. I said, you know, I wish I had the success that I have now in racing when I was younger, or the backing. I do get a lot of help. I get a lot of support, whether it be working in the shop or whatever. I get a ton of support now. And I was talking to my dad. I said, I wish when I was 22 years old or 20 years old, I had this going for me back then too. And he said, "Well, there's a difference, Jeff. You weren't the same person back then. You were a different driver. You were a different thing." Like, he said, it's so cool to watch me now versus when I first started racing. He sees me hit the brakes and not take the shot more than I take the shot. I mean, I'm calculated when I try to pass somebody instead of just trying to barrel in there and pass. I mean, I still have my times where I make questionable moves, but I drive differently now. And he said, that made you a better race car driver. He said, I really enjoy watching you race now because you race differently. You race with, you risk manage while you're on the track. And I can see you make those split second decisions. And it makes me proud to watch you and know what you used to be like and what you are now. So it definitely changes you.
That is very cool.
Yeah. Kind of sticking along the same questioning line that Caleb had, is there any event that you still have on your bucket list that you would like to, one, either go and race, or two, just to go and see?
To go watch, I would like to go to the King's Royal or one of those big crown jewel events there. I've never been to a track on the East Coast. Okay. I think it'd be cool to go to the East Coast. When I was out on the Outlaw Tour, we didn't go. We stayed Midwest and the West Coast. I would like to go see a track over on the East Coast. To go watch, yeah, the King's Royal or something like that. To go race, I think the one that's kind of on my bucket list that's more in reach for me as a driver would be like Trophy Cup.
Okay.
I think Trophy Cup kind of fits my bring up of driving, like, you know, with Deming and things like that and running bull rings and running in Oregon and California. I think that track really fits the West Coast driver. So I think my next race that I would like to hit, if depending on what happens with my program and things, I would like to try to maybe go do the Trophy Cup next year.
I think that would be a really fun race to. It's interesting to hear you say it fits the Washington driver style, because you're not the first person I feel like I've heard say that. It's a tight bull ring, which is pretty much similar to anything you run here in Washington. It's tight, and it's pretty much how a lot of California racing is too.
Yeah.
Have you made progress towards putting together your sprint car program? Because step one to running Trophy Cup is having a sprint car.
Yeah, I was I've been shopping around, trying to figure out how to make my program work. I mean, there's a lot of moving parts, with my partners, with my team, with my, I mean, my wife, like just moving parts. There's progress in the department. We're trying to figure out exactly how to go about it. There's talks of, a guy or two maybe putting me in a car. We've been talking back and forth. There's talks of a guy or two, potentially giving me a motor to run for the year. And then there's of course the last one that's, how do I make Westy Racing car owner, motor owner, and try to proceed with our own program that's been successful the last 4 years.
Right.
So it's kind of all up in the air right now. I'm definitely working on it every day. I've been on the phone, emails, talking, negotiating with my wife, like just trying to figure out. We actually had a talk last night about potentially partnering up and driving for somebody, pros and cons, or doing our own program and getting enough support with our partners and things to make it work internally. Or we're kind of weighing it back and forth. And she's actually she's showing interest in the different directions and telling me what she thinks. And it's pretty cool to try to figure it out. It's a little stressful, but we have time, but it comes quick. So there's progress, but we're still unknown the direction we want. And we're open to talking with people if they have an idea that they would bring on board or what they think they would do.
I mean, it is still October. We got a little while still, but you know, having it all in place before long in advance is going to be a big help if you can pull it off.
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but I also race for another team. So like I race still race the midgets, and I'm blessed to be able to race for Dale and Carmel. They bought Mike Burt's midget so we could race it this year. And Mike stayed on board with us as crew chief. And then next year it's looking like he had this goal at being 50. He wanted to rebuild his old truck that him and his dad had restored a long time ago. And he wanted to focus on that. And that was his goal when he turned 50. He wanted to retire from racing and start working on that truck and watching racing with his wife in the stands instead of being in the pits and having her sit by herself. So I respect that. I think that's really cool that he's sticking to it. But along with that, I don't get his help full time next year. So I got that midget program to help manage and work on. And Dale and Carmel are both, they're incredible people. Dale is learning and he's picking it up fast and learning the maintenance side of it, the shop side of it. And, you know, he got his first eye opening experience with me when he showed up and he's like, well, we got to take the hood off of the track. I'm like, no, we work on this during the week. We show up to the racetrack to go race and win. We do everything during the week. And so that's one of my big pet peeves is taking the hood off at the racetrack. I feel like you're behind when you do that and it ruins your night. And so, you know, we've established a program, a maintenance program that we actually are still doing race car nights. We did one on Tuesday to try to start building that up for next year, not only to get that one ahead, but that way I have a jump start on that program. So I'm not scrambling to get that program and my program together for next season. So I'm not only getting my own sprint car operation or potential partnership or whatever together, I'm also helping manage that midget team. And he has three cars that we got to get ready for next season. So.
Wow. That's a busy off season for you.
Lots of play.
And then the guy that is taking over the modified program, he's a buddy of mine too. So I got to help him make sure that that's all set up and good to go for the winter and help him teach him and everything I know with the modifieds and get him set in the right direction too. So I got like five cars to get ready for for next April.
Jog my memory. Are you looking for any sprint car? Or are you looking 360 or sporty or 410?
So me as a driver.
Yeah.
360 or 410. My ultimate goal is to be 410 racing before I stop racing. And by stopping racing, I told my wife, I said, if I'm driving for somebody or the sponsorship makes sense, I will continue. But if it takes away from the quarter midget program that I want to put together for my son, or if he doesn't want to race, but if it takes away from that, then I'm going to stop racing. So as far as the family program, that'll be shut down. But if it still works out, I'll keep going. But my ultimate goal is to be in 410 racing. Okay. I've never driven one. That's obviously the top tier in the racing world. That is, you know, that is the race car. So my ultimate goal is to be 410 racing, but I don't have the finances to be able to fund one myself. So My finances are Hornet. I'm trying to put together the right people in the right places and the financing and the team and everything to be able to do the sprint car thing next year. I'm not sure where it's going to be because the car, I can afford to get a car. I can't afford to buy a $50,000 motor or an $80,000 motor. I can't do that. And then along with that, if I lose a motor in the middle of the season and I have all these sponsors and partners that are relying on me to make every race, I don't know how I would fix that.
Yeah.
If a motor blew up. So that's part of my path in putting things together is the what ifs, worst case scenario, if we blow up a motor or whatever, how are we going to put that back together? The cars are not too much of a worry. I planned on trying to put two cars together for next year. So that way, it's wing sprint car racing. You're going to toast a car at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not necessarily every year, but you're going to destroy a car.
Yeah.
And so the motor is my main concern. If we were to somehow get the money together to go 410 racing, we need the backup money for if we lose the motor. We need to be able to keep going because I'm not going to let – my word is everything to me, and I'm not going to let the people down that support my racing.
That's commendable. That's really commendable. I respect that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It makes sense, right? I mean, if these people are going to put – if they're going to invest into you, your job is to give them the best return you can. You can't give them return if the car's not on the track.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of – sometimes I see it's a missed – a missed thing with a lot of race cars that I've grown up around and seen, like, you know, they'll junk a car. They went out and got $20,000 in sponsorship or whatever that number is. And they junk a car and they told their partners they were going to run 20 races. They junk a car on race 8. And they're like, well, I guess we're done for the year. I'm like, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
For one, that destroys a relationship with your partner that you had. And then a guy like me or Colton Heath or Trey Starks wants to go in there. And they're like, no, the last guy, he only ran 8 races and said he was running 20 and just left with the money. So we're not doing that anymore. So it's a snowball effect. And I firmly believe that if you promise to run, I mean, there's things for everything. If you break your back or do something like that, you got to figure it out. But there's a give and take. It's a full-time job to get and maintain sponsorships. You can't just take the money and say, okay, well, thanks, appreciate it, and then never do anything again. Like, it's a full-time job on the backside of trying to maintain those sponsorships and make sure that they're excited about racing. They're not going to continue to support you if they're not having fun with it too. And that's their hard-earned money. So that I take pride in my race program where I've had the same sponsors, give or take a couple that come in and out every year. I've had the same select sponsors for the last 4 seasons and they continue. Like, it's not a question of if they're going to be on the car next year. It's what do you think we can feasibly do this year kind of a mm-hmm. thing. So it's been really cool. Yeah, I look at that stuff differently now that I'm older and it's not just a gimme, gimme, gimme. It's what can I do for you as well as what you can do for us.
Beyond that too, a lot of those people have gone from partners, sponsors, however you want to frame it, to friends. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you've established those long-term relationships with those guys where they're in your pit area night in, night out, and you know, they're part of the family, much less part of the race team.
Yep, 100%. I actually go through more beer at the end of the night than I think anybody else in the pits because, you know, I make sure and grab extra beer because I want, you know, these sponsors and friends. Like, I go to dinner with these guys. Like, mm-hmm. They come over to my house and hang out with my family and, like, I want them to come down to my pits and hang out with us at the end of the year as a team or at the end of the night as a team. And they know where the beer cooler is. So that beer cooler is empty every weekend.
So what you're saying is you need a beer sponsor.
Yeah. Yeah.
There we go.
There's nothing better than having your whole team and family after the races and everybody's hanging out. And, you know, we have food sometimes after the races. It's just, that is a win to me. That, I mean, whether there's beer or not, I don't really, I mean, that's just a bonus or whatever, but I really enjoy having my whole family that we've built around this racing team. Everybody's smiling and having fun no matter how our night went. That's really fun to me.
Racing is a big family. That's for sure.
Yep. Yep.
Well, Jeff, it's been over an hour. I know both of you, yourself and Caleb are still working, so I won't take any more of your time. Caleb, thank you so much for co-hosting with me.
Am I the first one to go from like guest to co-host over the course of a week? Is that how that goes?
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Setting records. I love
exactly. it. Exactly. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. Caleb, thank you so much for joining me as well. I know you're busy over there at Joe's too, so we appreciate it.
Sat here and was, as I'm thinking of questions and listening to Jeff talk, we're putting up a brand new page with MicroSprint. So got some work done at the same time.
There you go. Well, tell Joe thank you.
Yeah, we'll do.
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah.
I'll make him listen.
Perfect. There you go. All right. Thank you so much, guys. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
All right. Take care. Thank you. Well, again, a big thanks to Caleb Hart for co-hosting with me and Jeff Westergaard for joining as well on this week's edition of On the Gas presented by Skagit Speedway. Off season here at Skagit Speedway, but if you're still looking to scratch that racing itch, well, you can follow us on all our social media platforms, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube as well. We'll have content posted throughout the off season. But again, if you're looking to scratch your racing itch, make sure you tune into Flow Racing tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday for the 31st Annual Trophy Cup presented by Abreu Vineyards, benefiting the Race Routine Foundation, powered by 26 Promotions. That kicks off tonight at Tulare Thunderbolt Raceway and then runs Friday and Saturday as well. Again, all streamed live on Flow Racing. Follow all the Tulare Trophy Cup social media. That's Tulare Trophy Cup on Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube as well to keep up with everything Trophy Cup. It's going to be a great 3 days of racing down in California, benefiting the Race Routine Foundation, presented by Abreu Vineyards and powered by 26 Promotions. Other than that, thank you so much for listening to this week's edition of On the Gas presented by Skagit Speedway. And we'll catch you in the next one. Take care, everyone.